And I appreciate the attorneys willing to be willing to go forward a little earlier. Our next case is the State of Minnesota versus Joshua William Dreyer. File is A22-0763. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. And, respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. Then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. As all parties are aware, this matter is being recorded, and there'll be an audio recording tomorrow, but our rules and practice prohibit private recording, so please respect that. With that, counsel for the appellant, you may begin. Just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Jennifer Lauerman, and I represent the appellant, Josh Dwyer. Issues the court needs to address today are whether Dwyer was entitled to relief under the Uniform Mandatory Disposition of Detainers Act, which I'll call the UMDDA for ease of talking today, whether or not Dwyer's attorney was ineffective, which rolls into the first issue, and whether or not Dwyer is entitled to a new trial because the district court gave an implicit bias jury instruction over the objection of both of the parties. Today, Mr. Dwyer requests this court reverse the district court's decision not to dismiss under the UMDDA, and additionally, he requests this court reverse and remand for a new trial because of the erroneous instruction that was given. Below, both of the parties agreed that Resendez versus State was controlling. However, Resendez did not deal with exactly the same issues and facts that this case presents. This court can look at how it decided Resendez in order to figure out how to resolve this case. In Resendez, a prison official sent the UMDDA request to the wrong prosecutor, and the wrong prosecutor never forwarded it anywhere. The court looked at whether or not the prison official had a duty to send it to the right prosecutor and what the remedy would be for that, if any. And then they looked at what the duties of the wrong prosecutor were and what a remedy would be for that, if any, for the defendant. During the pendency of the case, after Resendez pleaded guilty, he filed a post-conviction and also asserted ineffective assistance of counsel because counsel had not asserted the UMDDA claim. And the court said that would depend on whether or not the UMDDA claim would have been valid or would have been successful. The holdings in Resendez were that the statute was silent as to the remedy for the prison official's failure to comply with the duty to send it. And so shall in that case and in that provision of the statute was directory and not mandatory. They also said, or you also said, that the duties of the wrong prosecutor, there is no duty under the statute, and there was no remedy for the defendant in the statute, so that the wrong prosecutor did nothing, didn't matter with respect to the UMDDA claim. This case, slightly different issue.
Can I interrupt you, Judge Larkin, because we have several issues in your case I'd like to discuss. I'm glad that you brought up Resendez. I think it is an instructive case for this court's consideration. I see the dispute between the parties here as being who has the obligation to send the inmate's initial notice of request for disposition under UMDA. I don't like UMDA, but it might be easier to say than UUMDA. Whether that burden falls on the incarcerated person or the county attorney. And, you know, quite frankly, if the lawyers had teed that up as, well, the statute's ambiguous, we need to do statutory interpretation and figure it out, I think that would be a legitimate issue to raise in this case, because I do think it is a bit ambiguous. However, I don't want to invite you to go down that path, because when I look at Resendez, what I see is an opinion that says this. UMDA provides two forms of relief. It says if the Commissioner of Corrections doesn't notify an inmate that he has detainers within 1 year of finding out about those detainers, case gets dismissed. It also says that upon the district court's receipt of the notice from the inmate and the certificate from the Commissioner of Corrections saying, we have him, here's his sentence, here's what's left, the district court has to try the case within 180 days or a good time extension, or it loses jurisdiction. So what's meaningful to me about Renendez is, in that case, you had a situation where what was supposed to happen didn't happen. Here, we have a situation where what was supposed to happen didn't happen, and we can argue about whose fault it was. But in the end, the notice and the certificate were not delivered to the district court, which is the only thing that triggers the 180-day timeline. And to the extent we said in Renendez, look, we can't write additional remedies into this statute. That's what the legislature has to do. And if we weren't willing to write a new remedy into the statute in Renendez because the procedure fell apart, I wonder why you would expect us to do it in this case when the procedure fell apart.
I think the issue here,
I get that it's different. It's somebody didn't do what you said they were supposed to do,
but it is.
Big picture, it's not different because it's like, well, somebody didn't do what they were supposed to do, and therefore the process wasn't initiated correctly. And we've previously said we can't fix that because we can't write remedies into statute where the legislature has chosen to provide two very specific remedies, and this does not fall into that category.
There is a remedy in the statute that case gets dismissed in 180 days. Now, there are prerequisites for having that.
But the case the court loses jurisdiction if the court has not tried the case within 180 days or longer for good cause after receipt of the notice and the certificate. It's the court's receipt of notice and certificate that triggers the 180-day timeline, and that did not happen here. I don't see that the clock ever started.
Here the issue, though, is that the district court is holding Dwyer only responsible for the failure to initiate the process correctly.
The district court was wrong. Let's say it wasn't Dwyer's fault. In the end, the district court still did not get the certificate and the notice. Let's say it was no fault of Dwyer's. In Renendez, it was no fault of the defendant. And yet we said, sorry, there's no remedy. And in that case, we didn't have sort of an ambiguity about who was really responsible for serving the notice on the commissioner to trigger submission of the certificate to the district court. So it's even less clear to me here why we write a remedy for this case. At least in that case, we had commissioner shall do this, and the commissioner fell down on that duty. But it was a clearly articulated duty, and still we said that doesn't get you to a remedy. Here we seem to have an ambiguous statute and an argument that, you know, the county's supposed to do it. The inmate's supposed to do it. We don't know who's supposed to do it, but the bottom line is, just like Renendez, it didn't happen, so the timeline wasn't triggered.
If you look at in Resendez looked also at People versus Trancoso, Colorado, where they looked at and affirmed a dismissal of a case, saying the defendant's rights can't be defeated by prison officials who failed to comply with a statutory duty.
Here, we looked at that case and we said, we're not giving them a remedy. So I don't know that that helps you. I mean, if we weren't really to craft a remedy based on that Colorado case in Resendez, where the DOC had a clearly articulated duty to send the documents to the district court to trigger the timeline, why would we do it here?
Dwyer was prejudiced, and um,
Okay.
Let me help you out, Ms. Lauerman. Isn't your better argument ineffective assistance of counsel on this issue?
Absolutely. Ineffective assistance goes to this.
God knows that your client said, what's going on?
Right.
And for whatever reason, the lawyer was, you know, out to lunch. I mean,
absolutely. And Your Honor, Dwyer asserted back in February 4th in the transcript at 3, he said, I can't get a hold of my attorney. I can't. I told the court that. Then the prosecutor received his request February 19th, and it was served on defense counsel February 22nd. Defense counsel did nothing. My client re-raised the issue in July, arguably maybe a little bit early, and the court said, I'll reconsider this. Then he filed a motion and an affidavit, and in his affidavit, he supplied the kite that he had sent to prison officials trying to do that and was told, your case manager. The prison official send him the provisions of the statute. It's not clear from the record whether that happened, but what we do have in the record is them saying, contact your case manager, contact the county directly, not contact the county and the court.
Counsel, I have significant concerns about the level of representation your client received on the UMDA issue. He got a pretty good result at trial. He beat the second degree felony assault, so that's good. But on this UMDA issue, I fail to see any sort of argument that this was a strategic decision. I think, there's certain decisions a lawyer gets to make, certain decisions the client gets to make. I could certainly see a lawyer saying to a client, cases don't get better with age. You're probably best just not to rush this to trial. However, to the extent it prohibits your client from engaging in services to show that he's rehabilitated and try to get early release, I think that decision's got to be your client. And I don't see anything in this record that says that conversation was had with your client, which is very concerning to me. When the lawyer has been put on notice by the county attorney in the court that the client is asking for speedy resolution under UMDA. That said, there's two prongs to ineffective assistance of counsel, objectively unreasonable. A person could conclude that that representation was objectively unreasonable. What's the prejudice? Because as I understand the prejudice prong, what the court needs to ask is, assuming the lawyer had done what he should have done, which was perfect the UMDA process so the clock started, so there was a 160-day or 80-day timeline. Assuming that would have happened, this case would have been dismissed for lack of a trial. What in the record enables us to reach that conclusion on the prejudice prong, which I think we need to reach to give relief?
The other way to look at prejudice is whether he was prejudiced in programming. And there is evidence in the record that he was. Again,
case law that says that? Because Strickland says there's prejudice if the result of the proceeding would have been different, but for counsel's ineffective assistance. And what you're complaining about is he didn't get a trial. He didn't get an UMDA demand perfected. And then a trial within 180 days of that. So it's not just any prejudice, it's the result would have been different. And I guess when I look at this record and I see that finally, I guess in July, he demands a speedy trial under the rules, which then entitles him to a trial within 60 days because he's in custody. And I'll be darned, this district court held the trial within 60 days. So I guess what I ask myself is, why would we conclude that if there had been a perfected UMDA notification that started the 180-day clock, why do we think the judge wouldn't have tried this within 180 days when he was able to try it within 60 days of a speedy trial demand?
Your Honor, had the court received a properly perfected UMDDA request, it very well could have tried it. But if you look back to Resendez at 865, depth about prejudice, and they talk about Troncoso. And this court recognized that the Colorado Supreme Court in Troncoso noted that dismissal is generally not required when a prison official violates his UMDDA duties unless the evidence fails to establish that he wasn't prejudiced. Then the court goes on to talk about the fact that Resendez's prison sentence was concurrent. And the court said, any delay due to the negligence of the prison official or city attorney did not result in lengthening of the time he spent in custody, nor is there any evidence in the record that Resendez was prevented from participating in any work or rehabilitative programs. Here there is evidence in the record that was submitted in the form of the kites that went with his affidavit 35, and it shows that he was being prevented from joining in the work release program and that his custody status level was being affected by the delay and by having this open case. So this court has looked at whether or not programming was affected, and here there's evidence that it was. So this delay did prejudice him, whether or not you would say that the court would have dismissed it and argue that the court could have brought it to trial had it been properly perfected. The fact that it wasn't did prejudice him in the programming he received, which this court has looked at in Resendez.
Thank you, Ms. Lowerman. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. McCarthy?
Thank you. May it please the panel. My name is Sean McCarthy with the Rice County Attorney's Office. I appear on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. To jump right into the, and Judge Larkin, I love it. To jump right into OMDA, the...
I only learned that yesterday. It was unfamiliar to me.
Thank God it's not UFTA. That would be horrible.
We're going to rewrite some statutes to make an UFTA. But, the key here is, you know, the state's position, as you know, the clock never started. I'm not going to elaborate on that unless you have questions. To get more to the question of prejudice and, you know, remedy, I think the key here is, it's speculative, is the best that the appellant has offered you. That he hasn't said, I would have won if this issue had been raised. There's an attempt, I think, to argue that, but that's really not the outcome. The question is, would it have been a different outcome? Here's the best record evidence you got. Index 157, this is your note-taking moment if your clerks are listening in. Index 157 at lines 4 through 6, it's in respondent's brief on page 10. It's a direct quote from the trial court, from the judge himself, Judge Johnson, who said, in response to the defendant pro se, you know, at raising this UMDA issue, the judge says, the reason why you serve the court is so the court can make sure that your detainer is being upheld and we can set it on for hearings. This is a trial judge who clearly knows what the Uniform Mandatory Detainer or Disposition of Detainers Act is all about, knows that there's a timeline you got to follow, and had that issue been properly filed and the court been properly served with it, the judge would have done just what they did with the speedy trial demand. They would have got it set on and got it heard. At least it's just as likely that would have happened as it would have not happened. That's where I'm going with the appellant is offering only speculation as to the change of outcome here. A couple other factual items that I want to draw to the court's attention, I think, are important for your resolution of this specific case. The appellant here filed 9 separate pro se motions. If you're at all concerned about the level of representation by his counsel, it's incredibly convoluted on this record because the appellant, long before he ever started complaining about counsel, was trying to be his own lawyer and filing these very convoluted, difficult to understand, repetitive and overlapping pro se motions, all while he is represented by the public defender. That tends to undercut some of the challenge, or rather it highlights the context within this ineffective assistance of counsel claim comes up in. It's appellant trying to do things on his own without working together with his lawyer. and not telling his lawyer. And he's doing this long before he's ever complaining about having trouble reaching his lawyer. I'd submit that that's a factual aspect that your honors know from practice. If you got a client who's trying to be their own lawyer while you're trying to be their lawyer, that can make it infinitely more complicated and confusing to work with that client. In addition, appellant requested and received 5 separate continuances throughout this matter, including at one point, I believe, a waiver of the speedy trial before he reasserted it later on. So again, in terms of when you look at the record and you think, wow, this lawyer dropped the ball and never got back to him. In fact, this case started and stopped and started and stopped multiple times so that the lawyer could try to connect with the client. Those are factors I'd ask the court to at least weigh in on as part of the overall resolution of the case. With that, I want to give the panel an option here. If there's a specific piece I haven't addressed on the UMDA and the ineffective counsel that's on your minds, let me know. I'll jump right to that. Otherwise, I can just keep talking. I love that I get paid to talk.
Mr. MacArthur, I want to have you jump to an issue that I had not faced, and I didn't face it as a trial judge, this implicit bias instruction. I frankly was not aware, and that's because I've been now on this court for 4 years. But I did take note that that your office, whoever was trial counsel, whether it was you or someone else, objected to it as well at the closing. I understand it was given at the preliminary. And I look at the instruction, and it indeed seems to, well, personally, it almost looked a bit redundant to me of many other instructions that we give jurors in terms of setting aside biases and but listening to others and rethinking. So I'm just curious, and maybe it adds to our discussion, not to take away from your main argument on it, but do you know why the prosecutor also objected to it?
I do. Your Honor, this is a brand new instruction. At the time of this trial, that instruction was so new that the comments hadn't yet come out. So the instruction gets added to the jury instructions, the JIGs, but it doesn't yet have any comments explaining the history or what the committee did to come up with this jury instruction. Part of it is a little bit of it's kind of a post-George Floyd world. It's recognizing the implicit bias within the system and trying to find appropriate ways to address it. I also happen to know, and I think part of the court's question here is, well, why was everybody objecting? My understanding from, and again, may I at least answer the court's question to the degree that this is based on what I found out from my former colleague who tried the case, but I don't want to go there if that's something objectionable to Ms. Lauer.
I somewhat assume your answer would have to do that because I realize it's not in the record. And part of your argument is simply there's no, for the same reason, showing that it's erroneous to give it because number one, there's no law to reflect on it. And there has to be a burden met. But
how about this? Recognizing that there's a record issue here and acknowledging that this court may completely ignore this in its decision if it feels it's unfair and inappropriate. My understanding from consulting with both the public defender, who I see on a regular basis, and my former colleague, who was the prosecutor in this case, they both thought this was brand new, just like you, Judge Slater, said yourself. I've never seen this before. How do I deal with it? And their quick read of it was, gee, somebody on the jury is going to think we're calling them biased if we're the ones asking for this instruction. And we don't want them to think that because that might undermine their trust and confidence in what we're asking them to do. As simple as that. The state's position on this issue is the comments, which got promulgated after the respondent's brief was filed. I got to get the timing right here. Appellant files their brief. The comments didn't exist yet. They were not public. Shortly before my brief was due, those comments became public and I had access to them. I promptly called Ms. Lauerman to just give her a heads up. Hey, there's some additional piece here you had no access to. And if you want to bring a motion to have a chance to brief that or at least address it in the reply brief, I want to give you fair warning of that. And she was very gracious. We actually had a nice conversation about it. But I will acknowledge in response to your question, Judge, there really isn't any guidance until you get to the comments that help explain why did this instruction get created and why is it added to the JIGs. Does that help answer the court's question?
Well, it does in part, and I understand Ms. Lauerman's objection to the comments, but of course the comments themselves don't really answer the question. I assume the more affirmative question is whether it does interfere with the jury's deliberation the way they deem to deliberate. I think that I'm not saying that eloquently, but I believe that's Ms. Lauerman's.
I would agree. On the jury instruction, and perhaps Ms. Lauerman can address this as well. Assuming it was error to give the instruction over the objection of both attorneys, what's the prejudice?
Your Honor, I don't see any. I would argue that the instruction, all it does is say, hey, be mindful of your own internal potential for bias as you're making this decision and try to be careful that you're not letting those implicit or internal biases unfairly factor into decision-making. The state's position is there's no prejudice from that. That's the argument. I've got some time left, but quite honestly, we've discussed the things I really wanted to discuss, unless the panel has any remaining questions for the state. I would defer the remainder of my time, ask the court to affirm, and I recognize Ms. Lauerman has a chance to respond.
Seeing no questions from the panel, Ms. Lauerman, you'll have the last word, please.
And could I start with two things I'd like you to address?
Sure.
I appreciate your citing me to the section Versendez about prejudice. The problem I'm having with your argument is that section discussed or said, we generally don't dismiss under UMDA unless there's prejudice. Here, there was no prejudice because concurrent sentencing credit, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. There's a separate section of the opinion that deals with the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And there, the court didn't even get to prejudice. It just said there was no objectively unreasonable representation. So I feel like you're asking this court to adopt a different articulation of the prejudice standard for ineffective assistance of counsel claims when we have a clear articulation of that standard set forth in Strickland. And it feels like that's what you're asking us to do, because Strickland simply asked, would the outcome of the proceeding have been different? The proceeding is the court proceeding, and the outcome is the timeliness of the trial or the dismissal of the charges. And you're talking about prejudice as a result of the delay. I agree that's prejudice, but I don't know that that's prejudice that counts in the Strickland formulation. Would you like to address that? Because that's my thought on that argument.
Prejudice in the Strickland formulation for my client is that this process was never started. The time was never told because it wasn't sent to the Department of Corrections. That's the Strickland.
And if your client had done it correctly, the clock would have started. Why do we think the district court would have dismissed the case because it was not able to try the case in a timely fashion under UMDA?
Had the process started, it would assuming that the process started and going back to what Mr. McCarthy just pointed out, the court was very aware of the requirements. It's very likely that the court would have complied with this.
Well, then how is the prejudice under Strickland? Because what Strickland asked is, would the outcome of the proceeding have been different if the lawyer did what he should have done?
The outcome of this proceeding would have been different in that his trial would not have been in September. It would have been before August.
Okay, good answer. Now, could you answer the question regarding prejudice resulting from the alleged instructional error?
Sure. To draw a parallel to a different situation, the defendant has a right to decide whether or not it wants an instruction on whether the jury should infer anything from their decision to testify or not. And that's trial strategy. And they may not want to draw attention to that issue. This is very similar. The court gave the instruction at the beginning of the trial. Nobody objected. Here, both parties objected to the court giving the instruction, repeating the instruction directly prior to the jury going out to deliberate. And they told the court, we feel like this instruction invades on the jury's decision-making and how they make this decision. We feel like it's directing them. We feel like it's telling them how to deliberate. And that's index 148, 349 to 60-ish in the record. The court does it anyway. Then when the jury's deliberating, send a question to the court, and the court refers them back to the jury instructions and says, look at the instructions. We don't know, from my reading of the record, it's not clear what their question was. What we do know is what the court answered, refer back to the instructions. So the court has now again referred them back to this instruction, now that neither party wanted provided. And that was at 486, page 486 to 91 is where that happened. The jury asked the instruction and the parties decide how to deal with it. I think this was a split verdict. They acquitted on some, they found him guilty on others. So it's not as clear whether or not he played a role when the jury could not reach consensus that he either was guilty of everything or wasn't. And so when you have a split decision, it's a little more problematic.
Counsel, can I take you back to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue? And could you give me the record cite for something that tells us your client was not allowed to participate in services that were available to him while the detainer was pending?
In the affidavit that he filed, which was index 35, toward the top of that, and I don't have the exact page number because there's a lot of kites that were included, Your Honor, so my apologies. As you read through the kites, he talks about, I want to do work release, and it's a back and forth that this untried case prevents him from programming. It prevents him from doing these programs. And so there's a back and forth between him and prison officials, and that's documented in the stuff that he sent with his affidavit.
If a court finds that there has been ineffective assistance of counsel in a criminal matter, is the matter retried or is that a structural error? What happens?
In this case, Dwyer was prejudiced, and the appropriate remedy would be dismissal. Retrial does not help him.
Well, I understand retrial doesn't help him, but my question is, what does the law require if there's been a finding of ineffective assistance? If you don't know the answer, that's okay. I will find it easily.
I'll defer to the court to find that, and we're over time, so my apologies.
Not at all, Ms. Lauerman. Thank you so much for your thoughtful arguments. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. We appreciate it, and we will be issuing our opinion within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.